Okay, so welcome to the first and what will be a three-part series on what I'm calling the birth of the Talmud, how the oral law became a text. Unintentionally, this year there's been a bit of a theme to the series is in terms of the historical period. The most recent series we did was on the Book of Maccabees, which is in the period of the Hashmonaim, the Hasmoneans, right really at the beginning of the Second Temple period. This series really picks up with the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, with the destruction of the Second Temple, and then, not the next series, but the series after that, we're going to be talking about Jews and Christians during the Second Temple period and the kind of the split that happened. So had I planned this in advance, it would have been brilliant and clever, but I just realized this like a couple of weeks ago that I've unintentionally but fortuitously kind of hit this historical theme for at least a bunch of the series this year. But basically what my goal is over the next 3 weeks is to talk about the formation of the key texts from the period of Chazal, from the period of the sages. Chazal, we will soon hopefully start using a more specific term than Chazal, but Chazal is the catch-all term. It's an acronym for Chachmeinu Zichronam Livracha, our sages of blessed memory. And Chazal just means anyone who lived from roughly the period of 0 to 600 CE, which is a very, very rough number. We basically stick in the bucket labeled Chazal if they had a rabbi before their name, unofficially or officially. They are Chazal. But as we're going to see over the coming weeks, we can actually divide Chazal into very specific groupings, and within those groupings, specific generations, and that's really, really, really important when it comes to the formations of the texts. We are going to be looking at examples from the Tosefta, the Mishnah, the Yerushalmi, and the Bavli. Today we are going to talk about the Tosefta and the Mishnah. Next week we will talk about the Yerushalmi, and the week after we will talk about the Bavli, and hopefully be able to do it in about an hour, which, if I'm being honest, is probably going to be unlikely, because that's when everything goes to pot, but we don't need to worry about that right now, because today we're talking about the Mishnah and the Tosefta. Later on tonight, we will be looking at examples from the Mishnah and Tosefta. I do have source sheets, but we're not going to look at them right now, because this is kind of a, within each of these shiurim, there's kind of two different things going on. The first is kind of a more historical overview of how did the process happen by which this text came to be? And then the second part is, let's actually look at the text. Let's look at its distinctive features and understand. So the first part is going to be more me just talking about things. And then the second part is going to be, let's actually read the text inside and kind of get a better sense of what the text looks like. There's a couple of reasons why I think this is a really important topic to understand. The first is, we spend a lot of time talking about the importance of emunat chachamim, of faith in the sages. And that's a really, really amorphous term, that it's important for us to kind of respect and understand kind of the rabbinic mind. And personally, I think the best way to establish that is to understand its inner workings and to realize how it actually thinks, how it actually functions. I think Jewishly there is a value to seeing how the sausage is made, and that often when we actually see how we get from A to B, it's actually an enlightening experience rather than a revolting one. And the other kind of related to this, for those of you, because I've mentioned him many times before, my Rebbe from YU, Rabbi Jeremy Weider, he often emphasizes the importance of recognizing the brilliance of various rabbinic figures. So if you are in some religious circles, they will talk about Rashi's commentary to the Torah. Oh, it was written with Ruach HaKodesh. It was written almost through a divine spirit. And from his perspective, that kind of diminishes the fact that actually there was this human being who devoted his life to like poring over and creating this masterful commentary. And so again, when we talk about often the formation of the Gemarot, when we talk about how the Mishnah and Tosefta came to be, the way some people will portray it, it's almost as though this kind of like spark erupted from the heavens and kind of descended down. And when the dust settled, you know, they came out fully formed. Actually, this was an intellectual process over around 600 years, and especially by the time we get to the Bavli, they kind of cracked it up to 10 and really went crazy on the intellectual thought. So just broadly speaking, that's really why I think this is partly such an important topic to begin with. To kind of get into, so how did we get the Mishnah? How did we get the Tosefta? How did we get the oral law? actually becoming a fixed text. So kind of, you know, the Judaism 101 is we have Torah Shebechtav. We have the written Torah, the Chamisha Chumshei Torah, the five books of Moses. We have the entirety of Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible. That is the written text. Within that, there are a lot of laws, but there are also a lot of ambiguous things, and there are a lot of things that we do nowadays that aren't mentioned there at all. There is also a recognition of Torah Sheba'al Peh, of an oral law, of an oral tradition that goes throughout Jewish history, interpreting and understanding some of these biblical laws and basically crafting Judaism as we know it. What we're not going to talk about is what the Torah Sheba'al Peh looked like in kind of the Second Temple period, before the Mishnah kind of comes to be. We're going to talk about the formation of the Mishnah and the Tosefta. We're not really going to talk about what it looks like before that. I've spoken about this before in a few other contexts. For those of you who came to the kind of the formation of the Haggadah series, we talked about it then. But if you look even at the later books in Tanakh, you will start to see interpretations of biblical passages already taking place there. If you look at the works of the Second Temple period, the apocryphal works, once again, you see many interpretations of Jewish law already. You see evidence for Jews doing things that aren't explicitly stated in the Torah being done then also. My favorite source of, and I've mentioned this a bajillion times, my favorite source of what Jews were doing during the Second Temple period that seems to not at all be influenced by the Torah is the Christian Bible. The Christian Bible is an absolute treasure trove of this is what Jews were doing during the Second Temple period. So, Netilat Yadayim ritual hand washing. Jews were doing it then. It talks about it. The Haftarah. Jews were doing it then because Jesus does one. The custom to name a baby at his Brit Milah is one of the oldest customs we have. And the kind of the historical evidence that it's one of the oldest customs we have is the Christian Bible. It's a treasure trove. That's not to say, if you were to open a Gemara at random, turn to a page at random and find a law, it will be found in some previous source, but it is to say that it's not that the rabbis woke up one day during the period of 0 to 600 CE and decided to just start making up laws out of the blue. And it's a lot more complicated than that, it's a lot more nuanced than that, and it is clear that there is this tradition taking place long before they arrive on the scene. The best, I genuinely think it is the best analogy possibly for this, though it is likely to have zero resonance for any of you, so I apologize, but you have to listen to it, is soccer, association football. Here's what we know. In around the late 1800s, early 1900s, probably before that, there was a sport played by a lot of people throughout the United Kingdom. If you were to travel down to the town of Rugby, the fancy private school there in Rugby, and you were to take part in a game there, and then you were to travel, say, back up to Manchester and take part in a game there, there would be lots of similarities, lots of differences, but roughly speaking, it would look like the same proto-game. There would be a lot of similarities, even while there were tremendous differences. At some point, and I think the early 1900s, a group came along and they were like, let's actually make the laws of this game. Let's decide, rather than everyone doing what they want in all these different places, let's actually formalize these are the rules. And that process was an incredibly complicated process that we're not going to talk about in the soccer realm, but that was an incredibly complicated process that took place over time. It did lead to certain splinters. Rugby is a sport because the people who used to play their sport in rugby didn't want to abide by the rules of the Football Association and so created their own sport. But over time, you have this thing played by lots and lots of different people in lots and lots of different locations with some similarities, some differences, eventually coalescing into this clearly defined, everyone basically does the same thing in order for it to be called the name that the sport is known by. And that's basically what happens during this period that we're talking about. All the complications in codifying that law in deciding the rules of the halachic game is exactly what we're going to be talking about during the next few weeks. It's that process. These people decided we need to start putting, you know, rules to this stuff. We need to start, you know, codifying. We need to start making a more broad set of rules. And so that's basically what they did. And it took around 600 years and probably counting with some of the debates that still rage to this day. But that's basically the process. So we know before we talk about what we talk about, lots and lots of Jews were living a life. That the chances are, if you were to travel around to different parts of the land of Israel, there would be tremendous similarities, but also tremendous differences. You might notice certain people saying the Shema at different times of the day and night, but they would all be saying the Shema. They might be doing different things while they say the Shema, but they're all saying the Shema. That's kind of, you know, there are these things. Everyone acknowledges you do it. Just what exactly does it look like? That's the debate. But that's really where we enter the first major grouping of Chazal, and that is the rabbis who gave us the Mishnah and Tosafta, or really the rabbis who form the cast of the Mishnah and Tosafta, who are known as the Tanaim. The Tanaim literally means the teachers. This is one group. Basically, 0 to 200 CE is probably a terrible start and end date because it's too convenient and is definitely not an actual accurate date, but it's really convenient. 0 to 200, and then you go 200 to 400, then you go 400 to 600, and it's convenient enough, and no one, you know, is really going to carry it. Well, actually, there was a Tana living in 212 CE. Doesn't matter. The point is, 0 to 200 CE is the era we are going to talk about nowadays. It's the era we are going to talk about right now. And this gives us the Mishnah and Tosafta. So really, the question we have to ask first and foremost is, why did a group of rabbis, and in particular one specific rabbi, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, decide, let's actually officially codify the laws of Judaism. Let's take from this vast, you know, cornucopia, this vast smorgasbord of things people are doing, and let's try and bring rules and order to it. Why did they suddenly decide to stop? Well, if you lived in this town, you might do this. And if you lived in this town, you might do that. And Rabbi X said do A, and Rabbi Y said do B. And you know what? At the end of the day, people were all doing things that they were supposed to do, as they understood by their traditions. The simple answer, and my kind of general caveat for all of this, is I am painting with a tremendously broad brush that if you actually scratch beneath the surface of basically any statement I make, you find like 15 professors in 20 different universities to this day, all arguing about absolute minutiae of these things. But broadly speaking, the biggest impetus was probably the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. Because with it, there goes basically everything you ever know. Not only the religious functioning. When you have a temple, and that temple is in a central location, and there are people in that temple who are clearly the recognized leaders of the religion, things are, relatively speaking, simple. Indeed, Chazal always talk about the Sanhedrin, the halachic Supreme Court, and their seat at the Beit HaMikdash. If you have a Supreme Court, you don't necessarily have to worry about differences of opinion, because ultimately a Supreme Court can always rule and decide, you know, just as the modern day. Missouri can do one thing, Massachusetts can do another thing, and you have a Supreme Court that if you really need to, they can decide which one of the two of them is right. If you have a Supreme Court, it's great. If you have a centralized place of worship, it's great. Everything centralized, relatively speaking, things are simple. When the Beit HaMikdash is destroyed, boom, there goes everything basically overnight. The entire way of worshiping and serving God, boom, gone. But also you have a tremendous process of decentralization because now everyone's moving across the country. And so one argument for what started kind of the project of the Mishnah and the Tosafta, but I'm just going to talk about the Mishnah for now. What started the project of the Mishnah was this realization over time, over the next couple of hundred years, things were being forgotten. It is much harder to live a life when people are cut off from one another. And so what starts the process of this rabbinic project is we need to create the rules of the game, because otherwise, how will people know what to do? The more and more spread out people are, the less and less people can live securely in their own homes, the more likely people will forget things. It's a pretty simple explanation, and it's a pretty satisfying explanation for what started the project. Roughly speaking, there was this realization, we need to start bringing some order to how people are doing things, because when we've lost the true source of centralization, almost something else needs to be that centralizing force. rather than the Beit HaMikdash, let's make Jewish law that thing, roughly speaking, people are all in agreement on. And so what you have over the next four generations are a group of rabbis who live around the land of Israel, who are nonetheless continuing to interpret Torah Sheba'al Peh. They are continuing to teach their own students, and, you know, the students of the first generation become the second generation, the students of the second generation become the third generation. You get the idea. And so what I actually want to hand out already, and I apologize, it's only in Hebrew, but it's a map, and the key thing is the image itself. And I'll keep one. And if you just take and pass around. So it's a map, and it is taken from this absolutely incredible book called the Encyclopedia, L'Chochmei HaTalmud V'HaGaonim, the Encyclopedia of the Rabbis of the Talmud and also the Gaonic Era. And what this, it's actually two volumes. And what this book does amazingly is it gives you the biographies of basically anyone ever mentioned. It tells you when they lived, who were their students, you get the idea. What it also does really nicely at the front is it gives you maps. It gives you maps of where everyone lived, and it also gives you a lovely chart of the various generations of rabbis so that you can get a sense of, well, you know, who lived when. And who was their contemporary? Because one of the most important things when considering Chazal is to realize who was a contemporary of whom, because very often, and we will see this not today, but we will already see this next week with the Yerushalmi, just because the text presents rabbis talking to one another does not mean they are talking to one another across the room. The text has put them in conversation with one another, so it's often very important to kind of just generally understand the generations. The truth is, I happen to already own this, and I love this. There are now that it's been on my mind, there are a surprisingly large number of places you can go to find charts of Chazal. I just happened to notice we have this in the shul. This is Rabbi Aryeh Carmel's Aiding Talmud Study, which in the back of it has a couple of things. First of all, it has a very cool map of the region. One second. Very cool map of the region annotated, with basically lots and lots of rabbinic figures. And they also very nicely put a modern map on top of it, just so you get context. And what they also have is this lovely, lovely chart of who was a student of whom. I just discovered literally today that Art Scroll have just released an introduction to the Talmud, where they basically try to do the same thing as this in giving you the bios, and they also have charts of where everyone lived and maps. I am sure Koren have produced about 60 different books doing the same thing, but basically nowadays in the year 2020, I will also say Wikipedia is surprisingly good at biographies of rabbinic figures. Like, it knows a tremendous amount. So nowadays, it's actually relatively easy to find out when did such and such a person live and in what generation did they live. If you just kind of look at the map, so it's important to realize kind of who are the figures in the first and two generations of Tanai. So it's important to realize people like Hillel and Shammai. Hillel and Shammai don't really count as Tanai. They are the last of the pairs. Which were kind of the before there were Tanaim, there were other things. It gets very, very murky, very, very quickly. But based, because the Tanaim, I don't think called themselves Tanaim. I think that's kind of a retro, you know, term placed on them. Hillel and Shammai, maybe two of the most famous rabbinic figures, still live during the Second Temple period. Really, Tanaim is for people who were alive after it was destroyed. The first generation is kind of the classed as the year 40 through 80, according to the chart that I have in front of me. You get the rough idea. So Hillel and Shammai are kind of the pre-Tanaim. But the first generation is people like Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, which makes sense because he is best known for being the person who, after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, moved the location of rabbinic learning to the city of Yavna, which you can see in kind of the, basically on the kind of the southwest of the land of Israel, it's the one with basically 15,000 different names under it, because Yavne was the center of rabbinic learning. That's where a lot of people were moving. But you can already see people are living in the north too. Rabbi Yossi HaGalili, Rabbi Yossi the Galilean, is unsurprisingly living in the Galilee. And you can kind of start to see in these first two generations, there are several rabbinic names. The Rabban Gamliel, Rabbi Eliezer, and people like that. Some of the names that you often come across when learning, these are the people who are living in this early period. But what really becomes a defining moment for the Tanaim is if you turn the page, is he actually on here? They don't seem to have put him on here. Or can I just not find him? I don't think I can find him. Okay, anyway, don't bother turning the pages. Turning the pages is useless. But what happens is the third generation of Tanaim becomes absolutely defining for the project of the Mishnah, because that is when we get Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, one of the most famous of all the rabbinic figures in the Bavli, has all these famous, you know, legends associated with how he came to be the famous Rabbi Akiva, the Yerushalmi. He was just a regular guy who nonetheless became really, really great, and they spell his name differently, but it's still the same person. Rabbi Akiva ends up being this absolutely intellectual tour de force. Did they put him in the second? They put him on the first and second generation, which is strange. Something you will find is that sometimes people get debated over their actual generations, but it's weird because of the book where this map is from puts him clearly in the third generation, and yet on the map they put him in the second generation, which is interesting. I will say, and this actually comes up because you will see slightly under him is Rabbi Tarfon. Rabbi Tarfon is usually classed as a second-generation Tana, yet basically is always arguing with Rabbi Akiva, because there's obviously always overlap. If you think of kind of, you know, rabbis who are definitely not my generation, who I can still have conversations with, and vice versa, Rabbi Akiva basically wins, and I'm going to say almost always, because there's always that one place he doesn't, any debate in the Mishnah, Rabbi Akiva always wins. Usually he's arguing with Rabbi Tarfon always loses. And the reason for this is not just because Rabbi Akiva becomes an absolute intellectual tour de force, but because Rabbi Akiva's students become the defining rabbis of their generation. Rabbi Akiva's students, most famously Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, and Rabbi Shimon. These are kind of the rabbinic names that come up time and time again in the Mishnah. These are the fourth generation Tanaim. These are the students of Rabbi Akiva. And the most important reason why Rabbi Akiva is the defining rabbi of the Mishnah is because Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the guy who edited the Mishnah, is the grand student of Rabbi Akiva. And so you have this kind of, you know, two sides of a coin. Rabbi Akiva is an absolute intellectual tour de force, ends up teaching, then the most subsequent intellectual, you know, rabbinic figures of their generation, and thus you have this impact. The analogy, if you think of, say, you know, the 20th and 21st century, every rabbi in maybe the last 60 years to have walked out of Yeshiva University talks about Rav Soloveitchik like he was the greatest rabbinic thing since sliced bread. And that's because he was such a tour de force intellectually. If you went down to Lakewood, if you went down to the Beis Medrash Gevorah in Lakewood, they probably don't talk about Rav Soloveitchik at all. But if you meet anyone from YU for the past 60 years, either because they were one of his students, or their rabbi was one of his students. So if you look kind of at the oldest current generation of kind of Yeshiva University, Rashi Yeshiva, they are almost all students of Rav Soloveitchik. If you look at the next generation, they are almost all the students of his students. And so it creates this effect where he was this tremendous intellectual tour de force, but at the same time, he was such an intellectual tour de force that his impact is felt for so long, and people still talk about him, you know, as though he has, you know, unequivocal, you know, importance in discussions because of that impact he had. I am a great grand student. But admittedly, you know, my Rabbi Wieder does not talk about Rav Soloveitchik a ton. But the fact that, say, in this shul, I quote Rabbi Wieder every other week, maybe, Whereas if I, you know, if I was, a, you know, but I never talk about Rabbi Konigsberg, he never taught me. That's kind of the relationship. If I had been taught by Rabbi Konigsberg, I would never quote Rabbi Wieder, and I would always quote Rabbi Konigsberg. That's what's also happening at this point, is as we get this intellectual environment, different rabbis are impacting different students, and whichever students kind of rise to the top as the most important figures, they become the people who in turn become more and more and more idealized, they become more and more defining, and so the project of the Mishnah ends up becoming almost, this is how Rebbe Akiva thought Judaism should look. It's not that black and white, because it still preserves first-generation discussions, second-generation discussions, pre-Tanaitic discussions with Hillel and Shammai, but very often Rabbi Akiva's imprint on the Mishnah is there to be found, either because he is directly quoted or one of his most famous students is quoted. There is a tradition that if a Mishnah does not have an explicit rabbinic figure appended to it, that is the opinion of Rebbe Meir. Why Rebbe Meir? Because Rebbe Meir was known for being one of the most faithful transmitters of Rebbe Akiva's view. It's not his view. He was known, again, go back to kind of the Rav Soloveitchik example. If you look at his various students, different people have different reputations for adding their own twist to his words. And some students are, no, he was kind of, we trust if he was saying it, he actually heard it. If someone else says it, it's like, maybe they're adding their own thing on top of this here. Same too with the Mishnah. Rebbe Meir was known as, he's the guy, he just repeats exactly what he heard from Rebbe Akiva. And so if a Mishnah has no name associated with it, if a view has no name associated with it, it de facto is the view of Rebbe Akiva. Rebbe Akiva defines the Mishnah just as, you know, soccer got defined by England more than Scotland, kind of thing, even though they both had an equal seat at the table. That's basically how it works. You have all of these rabbis with all of these different viewpoints, but you start to get this funnel effect of some rabbis end up carrying greater weight than others due to their connection to previous intellectual luminaries or being an intellectual luminary themselves, which takes us to around the year 200 CE. Definitely not the actual date, but sometime around that. And that's when we actually get to, let's create the Mishnah. Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi, the grand student of Rebbe Akiva, decides it's time to actually make the rules of the game. During this period, different rabbis have been giving various impressions, giving various opinions on various things, and he decides it's time to take all of these opinions and basically cull from them and decide only a small number of opinions will remain. We'll talk about this a bit later, conveniently in a format that will be easily remembered because the Mishnah will not be written down. It will still remain an oral work even as he edits it. He didn't write down a text. It was still orally passed on at this stage. It was not written down. So what exactly that process looked like, I am not sure. I have heard different opinions. That basically, you know, I think the grandest opinion, whether it's true or not, it's a nice mental image, as you can imagine, this council of sages, and basically everyone's sharing their various views on matters, so it's like, let's talk about the Shema. And then everyone goes around the room saying their view on the Shema, and Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi is like, yes, no, 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 yes, no, no, yes. There you go. Boom. There we get Mishnah 1. Here are the various views recorded. Obviously, not actually like that, but you get the rough idea. The process of redaction, of editing the Mishnah, is taking all of these various views out there. And Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi decides, I'm going to preserve the ones that I think should be the ones that define what Judaism looks like. He preserves debate. Boy, does he preserve debate. But he doesn't preserve as much debate as he possibly could, which we will see very clearly because the Tosefta does. But the point is that he starts to refine far more, you know, these are the things that you can do, or can't do, but these things count towards the laws, these things don't count towards the laws. Again, if Rebbe Akiva said it, that's automatically getting in there. If Rebbe Tarfon said it, Maybe we'll put it in there just to be wrong. But the point is that various opinions are recorded of the sages, and it is orally redacted into what we have to this day, as the which is now written down, as the Mishnah. What's also important to realize, though, is that the process of kind of Torah Sheba Al Peh does not stop once he compiles the Mishnah. Otherwise, we would stop at this point, and there would be nothing else to talk about. But obviously, it will later create the Yerushalmi and the Bavli, but even within the Tanaim, the era of the Tanaim is not quite yet over. There is another generation, and this is where you really start to get into murky waters, because really the last generation of Tanaim, or also the first generation of Amoraim, who are the rabbis of the Gemara, who we'll talk about next week. Obviously, the last of something is always the first of something else. But from among that final generation is Rebbe Chista, Rav Chista. Rav Chista is a student of Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi. And for whatever reason, he decides to compile a slightly larger list of opinions. These opinions, by the way, don't just disappear. The Gemara, you know, read any page of Gemara and you realize that it always quotes an alternative opinion from the Tanaitic era floating out there in the ether somewhere. People were still committing to memory the other viewpoints that had been, you know, that were being said. One of the big things in the era of Chazal was to be someone who learned things off by heart. It was a really, really important job because that's basically how they remembered stuff. And it crops up a lot in, oh, this person was a better at his job than someone else. But basically, all of these rejected opinions aren't quite consigned to the waste bin of history. They do remain. They do endure. Some of them, I am sure, have completely disappeared. Some of them crop up as quoted in, say, the Gemara, and we have no other source. Some of them appear in certain Midrashim. But the most complete collection is the Tosefta. The Tosefta, edited by Rav Chista, is about three times the size of the Mishnah. It's absolutely mammoth in its size. The fact that it contains another generations of discussion also kind of makes it a commentary on the Mishnah. The Tosefta is another one of those kinds of works where, to this day, no one can agree what it is because it is too many things at once. But basically, it preserves a lot more discussions, another generation of discussions, but it kind of fills out. It gives a better sense of the various opinions out there. Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi wrote the rule book, but nonetheless, another work remained that was, you know, kind of all the rules that, I mean, sometimes the Mishnah and Tosefta will both quote the same opinion. Sometimes they'll quote the same opinion with slight nuances, and very, very often the Mishnah just ignores 25,000 opinions in the Tosefta. But those opinions did remain. They did survive. We literally have them to this day. We're about to read some in a second. But what we basically have at this point, the 200 CEs, at the close of the Tanaitic era, is the first effort to start really deciding the rules of the game. To really start deciding, let's bring some formal order to how Jews live. For the past however many hundreds of years, Jews might have done 50,000 things, and we're going to see examples of that in just a few moments when we start looking at the sources. In fact, now's a good time to start handing out the sources while I'm still talking, rather than having an awkward moment while I hand out the sources and we all just stare at our hands. But as we're about to see in the sources, Jews, for a long, long time, we're going to be talking about brachot. All of these sources are basically the source on the exact same thing, which is, you know, you make brachot before you eat foods. What bracha you make on a given food is basically the entire discussion we are going to be seeing for the next 3 weeks. And because each one, the Mishnah, the Tosefta, the Yerushalmi, and the Bavli, brings its own unique flavor to that discussion. But before we even look at the sources, in a sense, for hundreds and hundreds of years, Before a Jew would eat an apple, or a Jew would chew some wheat, or a Jew would eat, and that's an actual example, that wasn't just a weird one. That's an actual example we are going to see. A Jew would eat or drink anything, he or she would make a bracha. Almost certainly, if you were to bring Jews from a variety of different locations and hand them the same food, they would make a different bracha. By the end of the Mishnaic period, the goal is they will all make the same bracha. That's basically the point of the project. Let's try and bring some uniformity. Let's try and decide, going back to the soccer analogy, no, you can't use your hands anymore. That's not allowed. Let's at least all agree on that one thing. That's basically what's happening here. And so what we are going to see now in the sources themselves is a clear example of this process, and it will also highlight some of the key features to both of these sources. So I actually want to begin by looking at the Tosefta. So source number one, by the way, just to gain a sense of the size difference, compare source number one with source number two. Source number two is a Mishnah. It is the entirety of the topic of basically the brachot you make before foods. And you will notice the Tosefta is full of ellipses. I took out huge amounts of this Tosefta because it talks about a lot of other things. You already get a sense of the size difference. Of the Mishnah was designed to preserve a very slim set of laws, whereas the Tosefta is far more expansive. Something before we actually start reading, which is important to point out, is you will see even in the Hebrew title, which is pulled from Bar Ilan, it's the Tosefta in parentheses, the Lieberman Tosefta. So Lieberman here is Shaul Lieberman. Shaul Lieberman, one of the most fascinating figures of 20th century Jewry, was the bigwig at JTS for a long, long time. Fascinatingly, in one of those sliding doors moments in history, also had the opportunity to follow Rav Yitzchak Huttner to Yeshivas Chai in Berlin, which would have been a very interesting thing, chose to go to JTS instead. He was an absolute, when you think of intellectual luminaries, he was one of them. As with any text passed down throughout a very, very, very long period of time, and you get manuscripts, and you get people writing manuscripts, you get a lot of different variants. So there are a lot of competing versions of the Tosefta out there. In some Gemarot you can buy, they actually have the Tosefta in the back of them. That's usually a really, really bad version. That Tosefta very often is created to conform with the Gemara so as not to present too much of an alternative view. There are a bunch of versions out there. The kind of gold standard of Tosefta is the Lieberman Tosefta. And speaking of props, there is not a full Tosefta on everything, but on some of them. So this is the Tosefta Zoran, where Brachot, which is what we're talking about, is found in. And first thing is just, he has the text and he has kind of all these critical edition-y stuff and a few little comments. That's cool. That's basically what this is taken from. What actually makes this one of the greatest things ever made is the companion volume, where there are actually two companion volumes to just this, where basically he goes line by line back on the Tosefta and basically tells you anything and everything ever said up until his probably death or he stopped writing it, ever said on this topic. It is absolutely masterful. If you ever want to give a shiur and reverse engineer, you know, there are a few different kind of works out there you can do that with. Rav Yosef Karo's Beit Yosef is a classic. Aruch HaShulchan is a classic. But you find the relevant Tosefta and boom, you will know every single time this topic is quoted in basically anything ever known. And it is absolutely brilliant if you just want to be thorough. It's absolutely masterful. For our purposes, the only value to the Lieberman Tosefta is it's a really, really accurate version of the text, but it is more broadly a really, really, really cool thing to buy. Again, you can't buy on all of them, but you can buy on some of them. A friend of mine convinced me to buy these at the YU Sfarim sale. This may have been one of the first times it has made its way off my shelf in the past couple of years, but nonetheless, one day I will learn Tosefta Peah. But that day is not today. Fred, you want to...
Very quickly, is this the same Lieberman as in the Lieberman clause to prevent...
Yeah, this is the Shaul Lieberman. The guy. Okay, so now let's actually take a look at the Tesefta. And a lot of the things I've been saying are, you know, we're going to see very clearly. What we are going to see is a list of brachot you make before you eat or drink something, some of which are going to be incredibly familiar, others of which you have probably never seen before in your life. Let's go. So, by the way, Mishnah brachot, and an individual thing within a Mishnah is a Mishnah. Very easy. In the Tosefta, it's a halacha. So here we go with halacha gimel. Yayin chai. So I've transliterated a lot of things, and I apologize. I've had caught the bug of transliterating things with underdots now. So chets now are H underdots. Sadis are now S underdots. I tried to distinguish between Alephs and Ayins, though I know I'd have made a mistake. I apologize. I'm just going through a phase right now, and everyone has to suffer while I do it. Yeah. So I've always done KH for a Chaf. I've always done that. I've just usually done CH for a Chet, and I caught the bug. So Yayin Chai. Yayin Chai is raw wine. Mevarachin Alav Barei Peri Ha'etz. So you make the bracha of Ha'etz. The imnatan letocho mayim, if you dilute it with water and then it actually becomes wine, mevarachin alav borei pri hagefen. Divrei Rebbe Eliezer. This is the view of Rebbe Eliezer. I put a 2 before that, because he's a second generation Tana. Though then I kind of stopped trying to put these numbers because again it gets very confusing quickly. V'chachamim omrim, we're going to assume, even though chachamim is an amorphous term, we're going to assume they are contemporaries with Rebbe Eliezer in this case. Bein kach uvein kach mevarchin alav borei pri hagefen. Regardless, you make the bracha of borei pri hagefen. But we already see within the Tosefta subtleties emerging. The Chachamim want to keep things simple. Rebbe Eliezer wants to complicate things slightly. But we already see there are differences of an opinion. If you had 2 Jews, one was a student or influenced by Rebbe Eliezer, and one was a student of the Chachamim, and they were both drinking undiluted wine, they would each make a different bracha beforehand. This is, I mean, again, nowadays, yes, Sfardim and Ashkenazim do the same thing, but perhaps the distinctions aren't always as grand and as fundamental and as, you know, overwhelming as it is in this era. Halacha Dalet. Heviu lefanav mine targuma, if they bring before him a different types of desserts, not like as we think of desserts nowadays, but that kind of idea. Mevarachin alehan borei mine kisnin. You make a special bracha. That's not a bracha anyone makes nowadays, but that's the bracha. Al hazroim, on seeds, oimer borei mine zeroim, the creator of seeds. The al hadashayim omer borei mine dashayim. And on vegetation, there's a special bracha, dashayim. The al yurakot omer, and on vegetables, omer, borei pri ha'adama. Rebbe Yehuda omer, Rebbe Yehuda gives us a variant version here, baruch matzmiach adama bidvaro. That's already a lot of, if you think brachot are complicated as they are nowadays, right? It's shameful that I don't know off the top of my head how many they are, but 5 or 6, I'm gonna guess without actually counting them on my fingers. We already have seen about 20,000 of them, you know, in just one, you know, halacha dalad. We've seen a bunch of new ones, a bunch of variants. And then we continue, and then we get to halacha vav. Hakoses et hachitin. If you're chewing wheat, which was a thing, mevarich alehan bori mine zeraim. So again, you make that bracha of zeraim. Afan bashlan. If you bake it or cook it, im hayu perusot kayamet, if the pieces are recognizable, mevarich alehen hamotzi lecha min haaretz, ein haperusot kayamet, if you cannot, if the pieces are not recognizable, mevarich alehen borei mine mezonot. And then finally, hakoses et haorez, if you chew orez. Orez nowadays we translate as rice. Pretty certain it is not rice in these times. It is something else. What that is, I forgot to look up. It's not rice. Mevarich alav borei pri ha'adama. Af an boshlan. You cook it, bake it. Af al pi shaf rusot kayam. Even if the pieces are recognizable. Mevarich alehen borei mine mezonot. You always make a bracha of borei mine mezonot. what we see here are a lot of, especially when we're about to see the Mishnah in a few moments, a lot of nuances preserved in the Tosefta. A lot of differences of opinions. We have three or four, if you follow Rabbi Huda's variant of Hadamah, additional brachot to the ones we make. We have no, by the way, bracha of Shehakol here. I'd imagine that given the Tosefta has a bracha, the whole point of Shehakol is we have no other bracha to make on this, and the Tosefta has a bracha for every single thing ever made in the world, you don't need a catch-all term. But the point here is that we have a lot of different brachot, and just the Tosefta is far more casual about taking its time to explain all of this. There are, in this entire chapter, so bear in mind, there are eight Mishnayot in the sixth chapter of Brachot. There are 21 halachot in the Tosefta. It takes its time on a lot more. We see a fluidity within the Brachot also. Depending on its form, it might be one thing or another. So again, different people might have different viewpoints. You have to really, really know the type of thing you are eating. Is it a seed? Is it a grass? Is it a vegetable? You need to be able to, you know, tell about the pieces. It's a very, very complex system. You can imagine this is a nightmare to both learn off by heart, just try it, and follow. Way too complicated. This is not, practically speaking, a code. The Mishnah is designed to be a code. And if you want to see the difference between the two, just read the Mishnah. Ketzad mevarachin al ha-peirot. Source number two. What's the bracha on fruit? Al peirot ha-ilan, on fruit of the tree, omer, borei peri ha-eitz. Chutz min ha-yayin, except wine, sha'al ha-yayin, omer, borei peri ha-gafen. V'al ha-peirot ha-aretz, omer, fruit of the land, say, borei peri ha-adama. Chutz min ha-pat, except bread. Sha'al ha-pat hu omer, ha-moitzi lecha min ha-aretz. V'al ha-yurakot, omer, borei peri ha-adama. Rebbe Yehuda Omer, Borei Mine Deshaim. So on vegetables, you make Borei Pri Adama, and Rebbe Yehuda gives us a variant. There are a few things to unpack here. First of all, the brevity, but not just the brevity, this Mishnah has a beat. You can learn this off by heart very easily, because not only is it very boom, 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 conceptually it flows. What do we say on fruit? Well, fruit of the tree, boom. And then we have wine, which is different but related, boom. And then we have fruit of the ground, boom. And then we have, well, bread technically grows from the ground, exception. And then another round of fruit from the ground, and then the variant. It is, I mean, there are camps where kids learn Mishnayot off by heart. I would never want to ever go to those camps. But there's a reason why Mishnah is probably the one of the few things you could conceivably learn in a really, really depressing, miserable camp over a month, because it does have a beat. It is concise. It is simple. This Mishnah also cuts out, it just culls. You can imagine Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, someone suggesting maybe seeds and vegetables should have different brachot. No, that is not simple. That is not easy to follow. You want to make things as simple as possible. By the way, we've also called Borei Mine Mezonot, which we're going to see in coming weeks, is going to have to come back because we make it. And also the bracha of Shehakol has still not appeared. We have culled the list of brachot down to the barest bones, to the simplest possible things you could possibly do, with guiding rules. Basically, the Tosefta gave us specific kind of examples and categories. The Mishnah gives us conceptual categories. Where did it come from? Did it come from a tree? Did it come from a ground? If it came from the, you can flowchart this Mishnah really easily. You cannot flowchart this Tosefta as much as, the Tosefta gives you a table, the Mishnah basically gives you a flowchart. The Mishnah is designed to be memorizable. The Mishnah is designed to be simple. Codes are always best when they are simple, even if they are at their worst when they are simple. Codes are always, you know, better when they are simple. What we also see and is worth highlighting is, go back for a second to the Tosefta, the very last line of Halacha 4. We have a variant bracha from Rebbe Yehuda. Rebbe Yehuda Omer, Baruch Matzmiach Adama Bidvaro. If you look at the very last line of the Mishnah, we get a variant bracha from Rabbi Yehuda instead of Ha'adama. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Bore Mine Deshaim, which came up earlier in our Tosefta as a specific example. What we have here is a very clear example of this is why you write things down. Because oral traditions develop. What happened? Everyone knew Rabbi Yehuda had a variant understanding of Ha'adama. The problem is you get into the situation of, what was that variant? Oh, it was, I knew it was, it wasn't Ha'adama. Oh, it was Baruch Matzmiach Adama B'dvara. That makes sense. And then someone else in another room is going, it was Baruch Mine Deshaim. And someone's like, oh, that sounds familiar. I remember that being one of the, you know, other things. This is, and when we eventually get to the Bavli, and who, it will be interesting when we get there, the Bavli is chock full of this the whole time. Someone said this. Other people say they said this. And trying to figure out some of the mess that that creates. But the point is, what we see in this Mishnah is its beauty, its simplicity. It has a beat. It is memorizable. You see how we go in this first phase of, you know, the oral law turning into a text, even if it's still an oral text. We go from what had been for way more than 200 years, or everyone agreed you make brachot before you eat food, but there was this whole competing list of brachot, and I'm sure you could trawl through other rabbinic sources and create an even greater list of brachot possible that people were suggesting you should make on food items. But we had all of these different brachot, and Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi comes along, and really the rabbinic project of the Mishnah as a whole is, it's not good that everyone's playing by different rules. This is not exportable. This is not something that people will be able to live by easily, especially in an era of destruction. And especially as the Jewish community starts to spread out further and further, the simpler things are, the better. And so we get the Mishnah. The Tosefta preserves a lot more of this discussion, but we get all of this discussion condensed into just one simple, relatively easy flowchart to memorize, and it makes things really simple. And thus, the Mishnah. The Mishnah is such an influential and important work that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Nasi is the president of kind of the Supreme Court, is forever given that name. The Mishnah becomes a defining work, so much so that any rabbi who basically comes after the Mishnah is officially redacted into its oral form is no longer considered a Tana. Is no longer considered able to basically tweak the Mishnah. The Tanaim are the rabbis who legitimately disagreed about things in that era. Once the Mishnah is there, it's like, you can no longer change this. This is now a fixed thing. You can no longer debate these details like you could in the past. Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir, for example. Let's use the example of the Tosefta. Rabbi Eliezer and the Chachamim could have disagreed on the correct bracha to make on raw wine. But after the close of the Mishnah, and wine is borei pri hagefen, that's it. That is, the discussion is closed. The rabbis who come after this period no longer get the title Tanoim. They get a different name instead, because they still have a lot more work to do. But the point is it's just how influential it is. And again, to return to kind of the soccer analogy, ever since the FA decided the rules of soccer, you don't really change them. In fact, there's only one group of people who can change the rules of soccer. It's the people who created them to begin with. There is a 5-member panel of, like, the soccer kind of gods. 4 of that 5, one is English, one is Scottish, one is Northern Irish, one is Welsh, and then there is one international representative, because you got to have someone else on there. But the point is, no Argentinian is allowed to change the rules, because the rules were closed. The rules were closed, you know, by the English, by the United Kingdom, boom. The Tanaim, the Mishnah, closes the rules. No one gets to change anything in the Mishnah. That is a broad statement that will be refined over the next couple of weeks, because that is it. But we have a huge problem now with the Mishnah, because while its beauty lies in its simplicity, we have huge questions. If you want to chew wheat, What bracha do you make? It's not covered in the Mishnah. That case is not covered in the Mishnah. What if I kind of already made kind of an assumption that raw wine is considered wine in the Mishnah, but that's not explicitly laid out? The problem with simplicity, the beauty of the Tosefta is it covers a lot of bases. You can really, 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 you know exactly what is the specific case you are dealing with and know what the bracha is. You can't do that with the Mishnah. If you can't put something in an easy conceptual category, you do not know what bracha to make. And that is going to lead to the next 400 years of the rabbinic project, which can basically be summarized as, for the first 200 years, what was the Mishnah actually trying to say? And then the next 200 years is, what were they actually trying to say? But we will get to that in the third week. What we will turn to next week is the Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, because it is created over a much shorter time period, and it's much simpler to understand, and to talk about historically speaking, it's very, relatively speaking, a nice, it's horrible to learn, but a nice beast to work with from our purposes. And so what we will start to already see next week is the generations that followed the close of the Mishnah had to figure out, well, the rules of this game just aren't good enough. They don't cover enough situations. If you just give me this Mishnah and you tell me, live your bracha-making life based on this Mishnah, I do not know what to do in 1,000 different situations. And so what we are going to see over the next 2 weeks is that the next 400 years would be spent trying to figure out and bring more order and sense and cover more scenarios than the Mishnah ever could. And basically what we, in a sense, end up with, it's not actually an hourglass, but if we started with all of these bajillion opinions, and then eventually it's redacted into the Mishnah and the Tosefta, but the Mishnah, which kind of restricts it to just a very small number of opinions, what happens over the next 400 years is the expansion back of those opinions, which is a general phenomenon that always follows codification, is the expansion of opinions once again to try and cover more ground. And so we will start to see that with the misnamed Yerushalmi, which we will talk about next week.